Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. This is your old pal, Rob Vernon, and you have reached the Mind Changers podcast. Today, we're going to start heading back into the world of leadership and what it means and the different styles of it. So today, and for probably the next one as well, I want to focus on servant leadership, frankly, because I have to believe, or I do believe anyway, that the idea of servant leadership is the one that will carry us into the future, because the old command and control, top-down kind of thing stopped working in truth about 20 years ago when Gen X sort of fell into the fold of the process. But as somebody in that generation, we adapted to it, but it was incompatible with most of our back and forth, right? With most of our ideals. So what we found, is in the leadership universe, in management, in directional stuff, it means something to care for your employees and to care for the people that work for you and your coworkers and such. So that's really rather what I'd like to talk about today. Is it really gets into a little more about what it means to be a servant leader, right? So in the dynamic landscape of contemporary leadership, one approach stands out, really. I believe this to be true. Because it has a transformative impact on organizational culture and especially employee engagement, right? The term was coined by Robert Greenleaf in the early 70s, and the concept has gained widespread recognition for its emphasis on serving others as the primary objective of leadership. It's an inverted pyramid, right? So it's where you would see the boss and the CEO or somebody at the top. Yes, that's technically where they are, but what they do starts from the bottom up. And the workers, the folks who are doing the main work, the hardest job, are the ones technically at the top of the need chain or the food chain, as it were. That was rather the point of it. The stuff we're going to talk about, we'll dig into the benefits and the impact that it's had. What Greenleaf was talking about, it really kind of back in the 70s at AT&T. Greenleaf challenged traditional leadership models by proposing a more people-centric approach, right? It means something to say that, because the fact is, it was until then, it was you were really just a number. You got a gold watch of retirement, and these people stayed for a long time and all of that, but that's certainly not the case anymore, right? So the point is that the traditional stuff, the way that we built our world, the way that we built our nation, was rather based on how the military worked at the time. So that's why there was the command and control concepts, the whole, I'm the boss and you're the, I'm the superior, you're the subordinate kind of thing. And to a certain degree, the chain of command works that way. But realistically, it's not people-centric, it's organization-centric. It puts the dollar first, it puts the organization ahead of everything, which in the military you need. But day-to-day in a civil society, you don't necessarily need that. And so some of the core principles that we talk about in servant leadership is examining the principle of putting other needs before one's own and how that differs from traditional leadership models. So really what we're digging into here is the idea that the person who is doing the work is the people who take care of the people. And that's something I said even before I understood what servant leadership was, is you take care of the people who take care of the people, and the people will be happy, all of the people. And conversely, if you cannot change the people, you change the people. So if you cannot change their behavior, you change their employment status. But in essence, what it boils down to is empathy and emotional intelligence. So the concept of emotional intelligence in servant leadership is central, right? So you cannot be aloof. You have to be caring and concerned and compassionate, But you know, you still have to draw lines, and that's what your job is as a leader as well. But you do have to take everything that you're given and look at it from a holistic perspective. So, you know, empathy is critical. I think the most important thing a leader can be is empathetic, and then start making decisions based on that, equal to the idea of growth. Because if you have happy people, if you have good set, if folks who are working in your company or your organization or your agency have a positive experience and they're satisfied and there's a lot of job satisfaction, you don't have the turnover, and you have people desiring to be. So you want to be an employer of choice that way. And so it becomes important then to understand and connect with team members. So when we talk about moving into a personal growth and development, because the impact on the individuals is what's most important, right? So you want to foster a growth mindset. You want to say, you know what, we're going to create an environment that builds everyone up on their particular arc. Me personally, I had folks that were working for me, with me, that I had an arc for each and every one of them. We talked about it every so often and see if they agreed with it, and I would change whatever it is and try to fit into their particular arc, all the trainings and all the things that they needed. Unfortunately, in some of the stuff that I was doing, there was just no place for these folks to go. And, you know, you were kind of stuck in a box, right? So, and it was something that the folks above my head either completely understood and ignored, or did not understand at all, that you stop feeling valued after a while, even when you feel valued in the beginning, and you have to continue to keep things fresh and new and interesting, or give someone such inherent rock solid stability that they don't want to leave, right? That's the crux of the government employee, is that they're a person who likes stability and likes basic consistency, who likes a strong base that can't be pulled out from under them, right? Like in the corporate world, right? So but you still have to create that. Even in the corporate world, you still have to create that solid base in the long term, unless there's room to move and you can give folks new titles and new jobs and all of that. But in order to do that, in order to create personal growth and development, you have to build trust and most importantly, credibility. So you talk about workplace culture and you emphasize the role in fostering positive and supportive atmospheres, but you also say, you know, we create that positive work environment by saying, by creating that trust and credibility, and you allow folks to tell on themselves without, you know, beating them over the head or suspending them. You say, hey, you know what, I made a mistake. Here's where it is. Here's what we're going to do. You know, and you build trust and credibility with the team, which leads then to that positive work environment and that satisfaction, that sense of satisfaction and well-being. Because it creates then a good, strong, positive culture, and you can look at the role that it plays in being supportive to everyone, right? So, you know, you build mentors into your teams, you build coaches into your teams, you build trainers into your teams. They're not always the same person, by the way. Not everybody is a good trainer. Sometimes you have trainers that aren't so good, and they don't, either they don't understand the material, or they only understand it one way. And so you have to be able to build a system that allows you to train in a way that folks can move themselves towards, right? So you have to be flexible enough to make that a reality. So when we do this, what we kind of talk about is a large part of that really is the creation of work-life balance. Now, work-life balance, and I'm going to be probably too honest about that, work-life balance is mostly bullshit. You don't have to balance your work and your life. They are separate things, right? So you cannot bring your work home with you, but some folks are really good with that. There's a concept called span of control in the command circles of the world and in incident management circles. So the span of control means how many people that you can manage in one particular incident, right? So it's based on complexity. So what I mean by that is to say, if you have 10 people whose job it is to direct traffic, you don't need a supervisor every five people. But if you have an investigation going on with multiple layers and you have forensic accountants, you might need a supervisor every five accountants to overlook things and ask, answer questions and manage regulations and all that. So the idea used to be five to seven, but no more than 10. But now, what we've realized is that you can manage your personnel the same way yourself, the same way that you manage your personnel in the span of control mindset, and say, well, what does it mean for me to have a work-life balance? Well, it means that I like to answer emails and keep up on things, and it doesn't give me any extra stress. But if it does, I can always stop. So the option has to be with the person engaging in the balance. Some folks like to, when they clock out, they like to clock out, go home, call it a day. And there's nothing wrong with that. Even if you're highly paid, I'm gonna tell you something right now. I'm gonna set some things on the, on their ear. You don't have to take your work home with you. Even if you're paid $500,000 a year, the expectation is not that you are going to be 24/7, 365 owned and available. The money only has so much power. So you let that stuff go. You leave it be. You set things aside, right? And then when you're in the process of doing that, you are transparent yourself, and you hopefully your supervisors, your leadership, your administration, whoever it is the kind of leadership that allows for that to be your truth and to happen. So that is how you create servant leadership principles, create a healthier or at least contribute to a healthier work-life balance, is that they don't require you to do one thing or another. They require you to assess for yourself what work-life balance means and adhere to that. And you, as the employer, you, as the boss, you, as the supervisor, just don't blow anybody any crap about that. So that's really what it boils down to. Which what that does, ultimately, what that does is it enhances collaboration and it enhances team dynamics. So and to a degree, it helps with team building. So how servant leaders would promote a collaborative environment is by knocking down silos and encouraging open communication between multiple areas, between multiple personnel, between multiple departments, whatever it is. If you are if you're a large business, if you're a Fortune 500 company, a Fortune 100 or a Fortune 50 company, whatever it is, everybody who needs to has to be able to talk to everybody else. And to have open communication, right? That's critical, because what that does is it sets the foundation for a strategy, a team building strategy, right? And so that's the point of it, is to say you have to examine effective strategies employed by notable servant leaders. But once you do that, once you build those once you set that foundation, you build the teams on that foundation of openness and trust and good communication, and you will fail, you will stumble along the way. And the point there is to say you recognize those failures as failures, and you note them, you discuss them, and then you leave them behind. Which is to digress just a little. When someone comes to you in your office and says, "Hey, hey boss, I screwed up. I made this mistake and that mistake, and it cost the company a little bit of money." And I, the thing that you're going to do is not beat them about the head and shoulders or give them a suspension immediately. Say, "Okay, the first question is it fixed? If not, how do we fix it?" The other questions is, what are the impacts beyond the incident itself? And then, how do we return to normal? And everybody has the discussion. Everybody is open about it that's involved with it. And then this is the critical portion right here. Once you do that, once the mistake is made and all of the fixing of the mistake is fleshed out, that information, whatever that mistake was, must be brought to everyone. You don't have to say, "Oh, hey, look, stupid Susie made the mistake," or "Dumb Dumb Jim made the mistake." No. You say, this error was made, and other people are going to know who made it. It doesn't matter, but this error happened. So please be on the lookout for X, Y, and Z. put that in a knowledge base so that the folks who come out, who are onboarding to follow, will say, hey, you know, this is something I should know. So you create for the folks that come on behind you and the folks that you will continue to hire, you create for them a knowledge base of information that says, I have this information and these are some traps you should avoid. And they can note those and they can refer to them and everybody can refer to them. Which leads to the idea of conflict resolution. So conflict resolution is not difficult, but it is time consuming and it is a threat to the ego. The importance of open dialogue and leading to resolution is critical, but I talked about this just now is the importance of fostering a culture of good feedback. Even when something goes right, especially when something goes right, the recognition has to happen immediately. So when I say, the idea is for you to tell the truth about what happened and then we fix it, that's what I mean. And so you can't just beat random people over the head with certain things just because they particularly screwed up. Some things will require, some type of punishment or something, but you can do that without being punitive, right? Once you get the open communication and constructive feedback, that creates a situation where you are leading into continuous improvement. So continuous improvement is the goal ultimately through all of this. Really, everything is just a catalyst, a precursor to the idea of continuous improvement, because the idea of continuous improvement means everyone's getting better. All the tide is rising and all ships are going with it at whatever degree that they go. So what you end up doing when you do create that engagement, you change the engagement and the productivity. So you motivate a little bit through inspiration and a little bit through perspiration. You say, how we achieve your best? How do I achieve your best? And the increased productivity and engagement comes from recognition and communication and discussion about what happened that's good and what happened that's bad, and that people don't take too much of a beating for the things that they did wrong. Because what that does ultimately is it goes back to that foundation that I discussed before, is it says, we're going to reduce turnover and we're going to keep folks on longer when they feel more comfortable and they feel seen and heard. That's a little progressive language for me, but it is what it is. If you feel that you're being heard and understood and listened to, and even if the answer is no, or the answer is we can't, or the answer is we won't or shouldn't, you at least have been heard and you have your voice at the table, even though it might have been overridden. So you reduce turnover rates by listening to people and letting them talk and giving them autonomy and doing the things that are required and communicating with them. You can't beat, a 10-year employee someplace that is good at their job. You may notice a little burnout around year 3 to 5. And so you increase their capability and you give them more training and you do the things that are necessary. You give them the things that they're looking for on their particular arc and you give that to them. And when you do that, it creates an advocate. So your goal as a manager, as a supervisor, as a leader, is to create advocates for your organization. And the people who work in your shop should be the people who advocate the new people to come in. They bring new people in on their own. They want their friends and family to work where you work or where they work, so that they have people around them. And so that's going to be one of those things that reduces turnover altogether. What that ultimately does is leads to a condition of adaptability and innovation. And we encourage innovation by saying, this is the point. We encourage innovation by saying the following things. The following things are: blah 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 blah. We want good ideas. We want strong ideas loosely held. We want open mindedness. We want discussion. We want curiosity. We want to, people to want to learn. And then, this goes back to the seven C's of culture change: the adaptability to change, the servant leadership model's ability to navigate change and uncertainty, and promote organizational agility is unmatched, folks. It is unmatched because what it does is it says everybody is first, people are first, and the people that we serve, they're the ones that are guiding us and are pushing us forward. They're the thrust to our lift, right? So the customers or the people you serve are the thrust. The people who run the ship, who run the operation, they're your lift, and the person with the stick, they're the control. So it's a bit like an airplane, right? And you can use a ship model too if you feel like it. That's fine. But the reality is, everybody has to be able to move. You have to be agile, whether you have one employee, 100 employees, or 100,000 employees. You have to be able to move, and that's one of the greater failures of certain military units, especially, is they don't adapt quickly. It's a big boat, and it's hard to turn around, right? But that doesn't mean you can't. That just means you have to find different ways to do it. So becoming a bit adaptable to change and ability to change is critical. So when we do all this stuff and we talk about it, the two things that pop out are some case studies, and then Greenleaf is one of them. You know, the Greenleaf Center, you should do a little bit of digging on that. But another one is Southwest Airlines. I fly Southwest quite a bit doing what I do. And so going around where I go around and doing the things that I do, I run into Southwest a lot, and people are amazing on Southwest. I have really good attitudes on Southwest. I recently flew American, and it was the worst airline experience that I've ever had. No details are necessary, but suffice it to say that I probably won't be flying them again unless I'm forced to somehow. But there wasn't anybody who matched what Southwest was about. Even though Southwest is dealing with some issues right now, they're doing it as a team, which is fascinating to see. The overcoming of challenges, which you can create some change resistance here. You can, moving to the servant leadership model, you know, there's going to be some old school folks who want to hold things in their own control, right? People like their little fiefdoms. And in balancing that leadership style with organizational goals, there are going to be conflicts between servant leadership models and their service principles, rather, and there are going to be organizational objectives. And you have to learn how to strike a balance. So you can't just give away the store, but you also have to ensure that there's a profit made if you're in a profit business, or you have to ensure that the service that you're providing continues to flow. So you examine some of those conflicts and you make a good balance between the two of them. Some of the criticisms, of course, of servant leadership is one of the big ones is perceived weakness. And then what I talked about just a minute ago about the old school folks or the command and control kind of people who think that, you know, you work for me and I tell you what to do and that's that. Well, if you are doing that, you're probably, there's a good chance that your hiring sucks and you are hiring, you know, either angry, upset people or weak, malleable ones. You're not hiring for culture. You're not hiring for, folks who will fit in. And so there are many ways to do that. One of the better tests that I found is the Big Five. And so you run that on the folks, on all of your folks, and you get a good vibe for who works in your organization. And then you hire the people that match that kind of thing. So it's just a personality test, right? So it doesn't violate any rules or laws. It just says, this is what this means. And so if I'm open and agreeable and I'm not angry and I'm not all that, I'm not paranoid, that kind of stuff. So you have to find that thing, but you can be seen as weak sometimes. And it doesn't always work out. Measuring success. I think you will have to come up with some KPIs and you will have to come up with some employee feedback, right? So you'll have to figure that out. But ultimately what it boils down to is, do the KPIs continually matters. So in your continuous improvement process, you have to ask, what about the KPIs make a difference? What about the KPIs do they really reflect our performance, or are they just show? If you're not doing anything with the data, you're wasting your time in the collection of it. So make sure, above all, whatever data that you decide to collect as far as KPIs are concerned, and as far as even employee feedback is concerned, if you aren't doing anything with it, if you haven't done anything with the data in 6 months, stop collecting it. I'm going to say that again. If you haven't done anything with the data that you've gotten within 6 months, stop collecting it and find new data to collect and start collecting that, and then do something with your answers. Otherwise, you're just leaving meat on the bone, you're wasting your time, and you will make your people feel unheard, especially with the employee feedback stuff. So, in conclusion, servant leadership emerges as a powerful and transformative model that goes beyond conventional leadership paradigms. Its impact is evident not only in individual and team dynamics, but also in the overall success of organizations. By embracing the principles of serving others first, fostering collaboration, and promoting a culture of empathy and trust, servant leadership has the potential to shape the future of leadership in a rapidly changing world. As organizations seek sustainable and people-centric approaches to leadership, the adoption of servant leadership principles becomes not just an option, folks, but a strategic imperative for fostering success and growth. I want to say that again. Servant leadership is the future. With the move toward AI and the things that it's going to take away from most of your employees in the next decade, what you will come to realize is that the soft skills, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, cats and kittens, friends, the soft skills are going to be the main ones, okay? The accountants will disappear. Eventually, the lawyers will minimize themselves unless they make up rules that they can't be minimized, which is what lawyers do. But the fact of the matter is, most of the stuff that we deal with is essentially going to AI. So soft skills are the future. So all of that stuff having been said, thank you very much for your time today. I appreciate each and every one of you listening. I hope your holidays were wonderful, and I'm looking forward to the new year. More stuff coming out as soon as I can do it. More things are coming together immediately, so keep an ear here and keep an ear on the YouTube, Coach Rob V on the YouTube, and I've got a few things out there as well. So thank you very much for your time and your attention. Please go forth and see what good servant leadership can do for you, and do not forget to be excellent to each other. Bye-bye.